morning and out to school. The teacher is teaching the golden rule. American history and practical math. You study them hard and hoping to pass. Working your fingers right down to the bone. And the guy behind you won't leave you alone.
And good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. School is in session once again. It's our Back to School November edition of our book club. And we have a terrific book to talk about this hour. Narrative of the Life of Frederick Douglass. Written in 1845, Douglass wrote two more versions of his life story before he died in 1895. He is one of the giants of American oratory and literature, and his story is extremely compelling. By his death, he had become the most famous Negro, the word was then used, in the world, and known as the representative African-American of the United States, the black public intellectual. The book about it is about his years in slavery and his escape and how he learned to read and write, which is a crucial part of his story. We have two guests with us, Russ Castronovo, professor of English and American Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, who is with us regularly for these book club discussions. Hello, Russ. How are you?
I'm great. Good morning, Kathleen.
Thank you so much for being with us again. And also, Ivy Wilson, Associate Professor of English and American Studies at Northwestern University. Good morning, Ivy Wilson. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, great pleasure. Russ, let's start with you, because you have said that this book made you want to become a professor, which is a huge thing to say because you've read a lot of books. Why was it this book?
Well, you know, in my course of my studies, I wanted to understand something about the story of America, and I really discovered that I could not understand its fundamental contradictions without relying on Frederick Douglass. To my mind, there's no more prescient and incisive voice and thinker about how the United States would grapple with its legacy of freedom as well as its legacy of slavery.
Mm-hmm. And can you tell us a little bit more? I always like to know about the authors. Can you tell us a little bit more about his biography after he escaped?
Yeah, so Douglass, it's interesting. You know, he's in the narrative, as readers of the book know, he's very cagey, right? And he doesn't necessarily tell us how he escaped. But after he escapes, he begins a life as a laborer, joins the anti-slavery movement, meets William Lloyd Garrison, has an audience with with Abraham Lincoln at the White House, becomes central to the role of black troops fighting in the Civil War. Every major issue of the 19th century, you can find Frederick Douglass. He supports women's rights. He's an anti-imperialist. He supports the independence of various Caribbean nations like Haiti. So every major social and political issue, Frederick Douglass is there. And what he's bringing to the issue is his particular insight and history as having been a slave, as someone who understands the importance of freedom for people who are denied, you know, those rights.
Mm-hmm. Professor Ivy Wilson, why was it there were other slave narratives? Why is it that Frederick Douglass became what many have said is the most celebrated black author in history, really? Why Frederick Douglass?
Well, I mean, I think there are a number of reasons. One is that the distribution, the demographic distribution between the number of blacks who lived in the North and the number of blacks who lived or were enslaved primarily in the South, you're chucking on the order of a scale of one to, let's say, not a couple hundred thousand, but millions living in the South and tens of thousands living in the Northern states. So, which is to say that the so-called the black public sphere, that is the notion of that group of intellectuals and artists and writers and just free persons in general who are living primarily in cities like Philadelphia, Boston, and New York is relatively small. And they are, they're conscious of each other. They know each other's work really well. Douglass's narrative kind of catapults to the top. One, I think, not because there are a few slave narratives, there are many, many, there are dozens upon dozens of slave narratives, in fact, but I think the coupling of the artistry of his particular writing style joining up with his very high and polished rhetorical style catapulted Douglas to kind of the national spotlight, so to speak. It was a dual register between what was happening on the lecture circuit and also the way in which this particular narrative was traveling within reading communities.
If you ever wanted to impress on someone how important it is to learn to read and to write, give them a copy of this. It figures so prominently, doesn't it, Ivy, in his whole story, what he had to do to be able to read and to be able to write.
Yeah, you know, it's a really amazing story. There are prominent critics in the late 70s and early 80s describe this connection to literacy as the African American drive. The phrase was liberation through literacy, and one of the most important scenes, of course, is when he's learning to read and write from Mrs. Auld, and that engagement gets shut down pretty quickly from her husband. But one of the moments that I think is really key that literally embodies the notion of literacy and liberation is when Douglas and his compatriots choose to swallow their fugitive passes. They're thinking about liberation. They're thinking about escape. They're thinking about freedom, and they have to swallow the pieces of paper which have the words liberation or freedom, which figuratively symbolize the kind of freedom that they're yearning for.
Mm-hmm. Tell us, Russ, about the importance, and he writes about this. It was just so important to him when we look at one book that changed our lives for Frederick Douglass. It was The Columbian Orator. That was so important to him, that particular book.
Right, and I think we can look at the content of the book because it's a story about emancipation in Ireland. But even more than the content, what is important about the Columbian Orator is that Douglas sees in that a model of two people engaging in dialogue, and through the force of rhetoric, through the force of verbal mastery, one convincing the other about the necessity and indeed the righteousness of his freedom. So it provided a model for Douglas to see the rhetorical field as a battlefield. And when he's, of course, fighting Covey later in the book, those two merge, right? Because he understands that there's a physical battle that needs to be fought, but also there's an intellectual battle that needs to be waged as well. And that, what I think is so important about the Columbian Orator, is that Douglas sees that literacy is as important as a type of physical violence, but also that literacy itself is a type of physical act as well, right? And, you know, Douglas will say later in the book, he'll say, you know, my feet have been so cracked with crossed that the pen I am writing with might be laid in the gashes, right? So there's this deep connection between slave embodiment and writing. And that's something that we could think that American audiences would not think of, right? Because, of course, reading and writing and literacy is prohibited in many parts of the South.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the various masters that he had and his understanding of slavery. Ivy, if you want to, I don't know where you want to start, but I'm particularly interested in what he writes about. Is it Mrs. Auld?
Mrs. Auld, yes.
Who's very kind and tender, and he really cares for her, and she teaches him really a little bit about the alphabet, etc. And then she changes, and why she changed and how he understood that change and wrote about the change.
Yeah, I think that, you know, Douglas is everywhere at pains to show how the institution of chattel slavery is not only debasing the nations of black subjects, the nations would be black citizens, precluding them from very simple humanistic gestures like learning to read and write. In fact, it was a criminal act in most states to teach an African American how to read and write. That scene is also important for illustrating how not simply the economies, but the education of slavery is debasing whites as well. That is, this is a lesson not simply that this is not sorry. This is a moment. This is an episode that not only shows us readers how Douglas is being denied education. It's also an episode that shows us how Mrs. L is being re-educated away from the kind of sympathetic models, the models of sentimentalism that allowed her to express some human interaction with a young Douglas. So she is being re-educated through and in the ways of slavery proper. So, and this episode is not simply about the demonic transformation, if you will, of Mrs. L, but really how the system of slavery conditions a wide field of knowledge to instruct all of the participants who come within the pale of that system.
I'd like to hear you comment on that, Russ, please.
Yeah, you know, Ivy's exactly right about that. And I think the other key to this is that he's holding up a model, sort of an anti-model for white northern women who would likely be sympathetic to Douglas's cause or could be sympathetic to Douglas's cause, and trying to show them how sentiment, the very forces of sympathy that Ivy's referring to, could be used by white women in the North to help the plight of slaves and fugitive slaves like Frederick Douglass. So there's kind of a contrast here where Douglass is trying to, I think, make an alliance with liberal white northern women. And indeed, liberal white northern women will be at the forefront of the anti-slavery cause.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. You know, another way to think, I mean, Russ is right. I mean, one of the most beautiful things about the anti-slavery cause and in its early iterations is, were in fact the connections between white northern women and African American abolitionists of varying stripes. But you know, the narrative itself, that is the Douglass's 1845 narrative, has a latent, if not pronounced, didactic function to it. It's not simply the life story of Douglass. It's meant to be used as a tool of instruction. Hmm. And everywhere in the chapters are these little nuggets, such as the Mrs. Auld scene, that really have a didactic function to it. I mean, they work operationally as a lesson.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's interesting. The thing that struck me was how utterly, at a very young age, alone he was, and as he was writing for many others, how so many slaves were utterly alone. To not know, imagine that, to not know when you were born, to be separated from your mother very, very early, and thus not have much of a relationship with your siblings, to have all these different masters, to be at one place for 7 years or maybe 3 years, and then you go somewhere else, just utterly rootless. Isn't that just astounding?
You know, it is astounding, and we can think about, you know, how it would affect his development, how it would affect his connections, how it would affect his understanding of community and family. But I also want to point out, for Douglass, this is a philosophical issue, right? That fact of not having a birthday bothered him. It worried him throughout his whole life, because not having a birthday, I think, for Douglass meant that he couldn't enter into history, right? That if you don't know when you begin, if you don't know your origin, then you're kind of, you're denied a certain type of historical subjectivity, the ability to act in the world. And for Douglass, to be always denied that birthday and instead have his birthday keyed to something like harvest time or cherry picking time, put him in the order of the agricultural, put him in the order of the natural, the wild, and that of beast. And Douglass wants to say, no, I am a human being, I am a man. And having that birthday resonated for him, or not having the birthday resonated for him in a way that always was a certain type of lack that I think through writing, through the various processes that we're talking about, he overcame. I just want to point out that these things are gripping to him on a personal level, but also at an intellectual, philosophical level.
Mm-hmm. Ivy.
Yeah, I mean, much of my sentiment aligns with Russ's here. I would say too that Douglass becomes obsessed, if you will, with his birthday, or the fact that he cannot get an exact date. That information is precluded from him. And the scene that you mentioned, we just intimated a moment ago, the cubby scene where he famously says, "You have seen how a slave was made, how a man was made a slave. Now you'll see how a slave is made a man." Is about a transformation, And Douglas sees as integral to that transformation a genealogy, a beginning. So even though he's converted, there are multiple conversions that we'll see not only in the 1845 narrative, but the subsequent ones as well. There are many conversions from, again, from slave to citizen, from unknown subject to exemplar. But this notion of genealogy, this notion of being able to trace his past back to a beginning date haunts him, not simply beginning at least with the 1845 narrative, but going throughout all of his career as a writer. So, which is to say that he's quite conscious of transformation, but he also desires a beginning, and that beginning is forever precluded from him.
A beginning in many ways, right?
Beginning in many ways, yeah.
Yeah. We will welcome your phone calls. We're talking about our book club selection for the month of November, Narrative of the Life of Frederick Douglass. And we have two guiders with us, Russ Castronovo, our regular, who is a professor of English and American Studies at UW-Madison. Ivy Wilson is also with us, associate professor of English and director of American Studies at Northwestern University. We'd love to hear your thoughts about this extremely important and very moving and extremely troubling book. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655 for your comments on the narrative of the life of Frederick Douglass. We also have an email address you can use, which is talk@wpr.org, or go to our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, where there are always updates about what we're reading and what's on the list next. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We invite our audience to join the conversation now on this book. Martha in Menominee, hello.
Hello, good morning. I can't wait to read this book. I have not read about Frederick Douglass since I did a book report in sixth grade, and I'm 54 years old now. But at the time, the story, and it was, you know, it's one of those scholastic books, and so it was, I'm sure, I hate to use the expression, but kind of dumbed down, you know, for children. But it was fascinating. And every child in my class, my teacher let me read from the book. I guess she thought I was a good reader. And we left off at the hook, you know, at where he's at the auction block. And the auctioneer is saying, going, going, going. And of course, you know, at that point, I had to say, now, if you want to hear the rest, you got to read the book. And every child in that class was on the edge of their seat. And this was in Northern Virginia back in the 60s. And our school was just being integrated. And it was just fascinating, the story. So I can't wait to read the real story, you know, everything that we didn't get in sixth grade.
Hmm. Well, I'm so glad you called. Ivy, would you like to respond?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I'd love to. I'm struck by the caller's last comment. It's just the trailing comment that she read it just as the schools were being integrated. That you know, this is a key moment in U.S. history, especially in the 20th century, and we see Douglass's history. We see his literature rising increasingly from his publication. From his initial publication in 1845, throughout the contemporary day now. But I would say that there are also very distinct moments in which his narrative is punctuated, and one is during the civil rights movement. Another is earlier in the 20th century, during a period of artistic creation we call the Harlem Renaissance, and then at the turn of the century, between 1890 and 1910. In a moment that we think about now as so-called racial uplift, Douglass's narratives and his stories are in heavy circulation. But I would also note, when I commented on her initial statement here, that she read it as a child, and Douglass's narrative somehow can speak to multiple audiences in terms of his sophistication. That is, it's in this case, it's much closer to Benjamin Franklin's autobiography, which many high school students also read is the magnificence of the text as a document, as a kind of cultural artifact, is that the registers of his language are equally assumable by younger audiences as well as older, ostensibly more sophisticated readers. And I think Douglas finds a magnificent and beautiful way to pitch and to articulate the horrors of slavery that has the widest possible readership. It's an amazing act of writing. It's a phenomenal accomplishment that he could find a style, a voice, a tone that allows his story to be told and read and assumed by many different kinds of audiences.
Mm-hmm. You teach this in your classes, don't you, Russ?
Yes, I do. And one of the things I when I teach it, you know, I talk about the way that there are sections of this text that you can literally hear it as being spoken upon the abolitionist lecture circuit. And I think that speaks to what the last caller was saying about as the force, the way that the words in even the scholastic version of Frederick Douglass's narratives gripped an entire room of sixth graders. And one of the particular scenes in which you can hear that is, for instance, when early on Douglass is describing the beating of his Aunt Hester. And if you look at that passage, the way he uses the word whip, it keeps recurring in the passage. He keeps saying, there he whipped the longest, he whipped her there, he whipped her there. And the word whip sort of functions like a whip in the passage. He uses it to punctuate, to impress upon his reader, to get a graphic image of the abuse that this woman is undergoing. And it's really, it resonates. It haunts readers. It's a horrible, gory scene, but that is communicated to readers with such force because you can hear it being spoken.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what Douglass was able to do in this narrative. I think it's some of the more moving passages. It's important to imagine him standing before an audience, giving this as a speech, and thinking about the groans, the tears, the outrage that his words would have produced in an audience in 1840 before he wrote this as a narrative.
And while he is with one, probably his most brutish master, the spirit is whipped out of Douglass as well. I have a hard time watching films with a lot of horror in them, and I had a hard time with a lot of these passages because he writes it so vividly, you can just see it, and it really makes you sick. And I think it was Henry Louis Gates who wrote in his intro, that's the book that I have, that while he was with Covey, the guy's name was, he became a brutish man, no longer interested in reading or in freedom, and capable only of resting from his injuries and from exhaustion. There was a point where he was beaten. He subsequently got up in a strong way, but he was whipped into exhaustion. Ivy?
Right.
I'm sorry, Russ?
No, I was just going to say this is exactly what Ivy mentioned earlier, that the first half of the process where a man is made into a slave, and Douglass has to, you know, to transform, right, to become a slave who becomes a man, right? What we see in the Covey episode is the process where a man becomes a brute. But also to say that Douglass saw that foundation being laid not just by Covey, but by the entire system of slavery that begins with the denial of his birthday, right? Brutes don't have birthdays.
Mm.
Men have birthdays. So we need to understand that Douglass is talking not only about Covey, but an entire systemic institution that denies humanity in a programmatic, organized, legal way.
Mm-hmm. Ivy, at what point does Douglass decide, and what makes him decide that he's going to fight back? That's a dramatic part of the book.
It is a dramatic thing. It's not a perplexing moment per se, but the reasons have never actually been clear to me. That is, what became the trigger point? Why this moment? Why this beating? Why this denial? Why this moment of cruelty became the straw that broke the camel's back, so to speak? I'm amazed at what I find amazing about this moment is how young Douglass is. In fact,
yes.
We the narrative itself is so polished because he's a master wordsmith. And he has no, I'm putting emphasis on the notion of master with some degree of irony, because he has very little control over his, he has very little mastery over his body, so he takes control over his words, and he's trying to align those two things, mastery over his words and his body. But he's really young at this point, and when he fights, when he engages in the fight with Covey, it's not clear. I mean, there are so many atrocities and so many assaults that were leveled within the system of slavery that essentially any one of these violations would have been enough to be the trigger. But I think because Douglas focuses so much attention on the quotidian, everyday, systemic nature of that violence. That is, all of them are assaults, even though we have even though they're being registered and leveled on a kind of quotidian basis, that any one of these violations can and in fact should be enough to engage in this kind of personal revolution against the institution of slavery.
Let's go to Gigi from Viroqua. Hi, Gigi.
Hi, Kathleen. I have so many thoughts about this book. And the first one, and in the first chapter, was that it was burning with evil. And then the second one reminded me of a monument there is in Viroqua that was placed in 1930, and it's commemorating July 4th, 1856, when Lucy Stone, who was the rising star of the women's movement, came to the Great Northwest and gave us an address to a celebration that day. And she delivered the first woman's rights address and anti-slavery speech. And the plaque says, "The platform broke down. Rising unhurt, she cried, 'So will this nation fall unless slavery is abolished.'" Hmm. And that is a commemorative piece in Viroqua.
I'll have to see that the next time I'm there.
It's on Rock Street in the little Pioneer Cemetery.
Mm-hmm.
And then I have a question. In other books that Douglas wrote, does he describe how he escaped from slavery? In this one, he did not.
Okay.
I'll take my comment.
Thank you, Gigi. Thanks for the call. Whoever would like to go first, go ahead.
Ivy, why don't you go ahead?
Yeah, sure.
Ivy.
Douglas, obviously for strategic reasons, he withholds that information from this particular audience. That is, slavery is still very much a live institution. And in fact, the networks of slavery are going to get more imbricated. The passage of the Fugitive Slave Act in the 1850s. So it becomes necessary, not just aesthetically as a kind of cliffhanger motif within the aesthetics of writing, but it becomes necessary to withhold that information. But the scene is variously described in 1845, 1855, and then in his last autobiography. But I would actually set not the description of the escape as it's tracked in the autobiographies, but really how he describes the escape in his speeches, which we have a large archive of material. That is, the way he talks about it, and that is the escape, where he does give more details to different audiences, especially post slavery, but not before the Civil War.
And just to follow up, in My Bondage and My Freedom, the 1855 narrative, yeah. Douglas will say, he will cite another slave narrative, one written by Henry Box Brown. And Henry Box Brown was someone who literally mailed himself to the North and then told about it in detail. And Douglas is critical of Henry Box Brown because he says, how many other slaves could avail themselves of the same method? before, if, you know, Box Brown hadn't disclosed how it happened. But there's another word here that I would just pick up on that I've used is cliffhanger. And Douglas is really conscious about not wanting to write entertainment. Right? He wants us to be didactic, as Ivy Wilson has said. He doesn't want to create a blockbuster movie for people to watch, to be thrilled at, to be moved, but then not take any action. So I think he needs to deny telling people about his escape because it's not for their entertainment.
Yeah.
Right? This is not a movie that people are watching. This is the story of his life as an American slave. So in the 45 narrative, he purposely will keep his audience in ignorance, not just so that he has power over the Southern slaveholder, but also so that he has power over his Northern audiences, who, we have to remember, want to make him a curiosity, right? Something to listen to. And he wants to insist that he is, you know, a speaker who has a political critique to a level, and he doesn't want that to be watered down because people read this as the next sensational installment, mm-hmm. right? He needs this to be gripping, to have gravitas. And so that's why he doesn't tell us, you know, about that escape.
I like Gigi's phrase that there is much in this book that is just burning with evil, isn't there? There is evil.
Right. There's that religious rhetoric that comes out when he, for instance, and his other slaves, they called Covey the snake.
Yeah.
Right. And there's that, you know, the allusion to that, you know, the fundamental evil in the Garden of Eden, which is, you know, in play here.
We'll hold off on Christianity and how it finds its way in the book. And but let's go to somebody who wrote in. Michelle writes, how involved was Frederick Douglass in the process of getting the 13th Amendment passed? I was sorry that he was not even mentioned in the recent Lincoln movie. Ivy?
Oh, well, yeah, there's considerable debate about amongst historians in particular about not necessarily the debates among African Americans themselves, which are well documented in the so-called convention movements, and then later on during the Civil War itself, but whether or not white elected politicians, had listened to the votes, if you will, or the voices of these Black American intellectuals. Douglass being in the North in particular. And being seen as the leading race man, did have an audience with elected officials in the North. But what I want to stress is whether or not there was a direct audience, so to speak, a moment that we can pinpoint our fingers to whereby a group of Black intellectuals went to an elected official. What I would say is that the language and the conversations that are circulating amongst these African Americans actually gets recirculated into the kind of the wider public sphere discourse about Black equality, about Black rights, about Black citizenship, which is to say that what's more important is not whether or not Douglass himself had a direct influence on the passage of the 13th Amendment, but whether or not Douglass was part and parcel of a larger Black collectivity that was engaged with pressing the discourse of rights and citizenship in a wider register.
Russ?
You know, I haven't seen Lincoln, but from what I've been reading in the press, there is a minimization in the film of Black abolitionist circles as contributing to the 13th Amendment in the way that Ivy is speaking of. In fact, in the New York Times, Eric Foner, the celebrated historian of African American history, recently wrote about this mm-hmm. in a letter talking about how the film sort of underestimates the contributions of the Black public sphere to the passage of the 13th Amendment and Lincoln's own thinking. And mm-hmm. we should say Lincoln's own evolving thinking on the question of Black freedom and citizenship.
Yeah, I wish some of those scenes, at least, the movie took on so much, I wish some of those scenes could have been a part of the movie. But when I read that review, I also thought somebody ought to do that movie because that would be a compelling movie as well.
Yeah, I'm sorry, if I could just say one thing here.
Sure, of course.
It'd be interesting to set off Spielberg's most recent outing with Lincoln. against one of the other most popular Civil War films, Glory, which came out in the 80s, or in the late 80s, starring Denzel Washington and Matthew Broderick, because there is a Frederick Douglass figure in the Boston Exchange there. And but this is not about the 13th Amendment per se. It's about the availability and the right of Black American men to use the force of violence as soldiers to fight on behalf of their own rights. So there is those two movies are really distinct and different in thinking about Douglass's position to lobby for Black citizenship through rights, or to fight for Black citizenship as in Glory, as in depicting Glory, to fight for Black citizenship by becoming soldiers.
All right, let's talk about the church for a little bit here. And we haven't read very much from this book. This is an appendix to the life of Frederick Douglass, in which he writes, "I contemplate the religious pomp and show, together with the horrible inconsistencies which everywhere surround me. We have men stealers for ministers, women whippers for missionaries, and cradle plunderers for church members. The man who wields the blood-clotted cowskin during the week fills the pulpit on Sunday and claims to be a minister of the meek and lowly Jesus." That's only the beginning of what he has to say. Can you talk a little bit about the meetings that he had at churches, and how Christianity was used in some ways to condone slavery? Russ?
You know, there's a long tradition of pro-slavery religious commentary in which scholars in the 1840s, 1850s would return to the Bible and provide and find in the Bible justifications for slavery, to say that it is a patriarchal institution, that it was practiced by early Christians, that it should continue to be practiced today, and that God indeed wants the enslavement of certain peoples to, in order to secure their salvation later. And for Douglass, this is as you've read in that passage, is a glaring contradiction. So the big question, I think, for Douglass is, what sort of belief, what sort of understanding of the divine is Douglass going to have when every day around him he sees these violators of human rights professing the morality of Christians? And this is a contradiction that is everywhere in the narrative. What sort of religious sensibility is available to a man like Frederick Douglass when everywhere around him other men, other white men and women, are referring to the Bible, using the Bible to legitimate his enslavement?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I would add just two other comments, which dovetail with Russ's. One is to take the opposite side, that one interpretation of one mode of biblical interpretation was that extended from the language that blacks, in this case African Americans, were the descendants of Ham, and therefore were naturally inclined and deserved to be enslaved.
Mm-hmm.
Another is something that we would now identify as liberation theology, one which would say to treat one neighbor as you would want to treat yourself, the golden rule. And so there was another train of biblical interpretation that said that was used for anti-slavery purposes. So Douglass is really ambivalent about the use of Christianity. He sees in his experience and taking a survey of the landscape, he sees it as being used for ill. But there's also a movement, particularly within white progressives in the North and African American intellectuals as well, which are directly tied to the church. And I'm thinking of someone like the poet Francis Harper, who is a contemporary of Douglass, who is very Christian and is thinking about the way in which another language about interpretation of Christianity can be used to attack an institution. And insofar as that there are at least two different ways of using Christianity either for or against slavery. There's another moment in the narrative which is, as Russ mentioned the words the spiritual. There's another example in the text that's a different religious system or different system of spiritualism that's not Christian that Douglas encounters, and though he doesn't quite accept it. And this is when that crucial scene where they're going to escape, and Sandy Jenkins gives him a root, which is this kind of folk or vernacular, but ostensibly non-Christian
yes.
form of religion. Douglas doesn't quite believe it. It's not legible to him quite yet. He doesn't quite understand its kind of mystic properties, so to speak. So what I would say is that even though Douglas has taken a wide view, a kind of panoramic view of the social landscape around him, particularly how Christianity is being used, there's this slither of a moment, this slight little aperture where another kind of religious system enters into the text to work against or to be contrasted with Christianity.
Mm. We take more phone calls in a moment. You're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio, and we're having a monthly book club discussion. We're in our November discussion, and it's the narrative of the life of Frederick Douglass, an American slave. If you haven't read it, we all recommend highly that you read it, because it is such an important book in American history, and it is just so well written. And the story, need I say more? It's a story, huge story. Well, our guests are Russ Castronovo, professor of English and American Studies at UW-Madison, who's been guiding us through all of our book club discussions. Ivy Wilson is joining us for this particular discussion, associate professor of English and director of American Studies at Northwestern University. We have lines open, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, or you can use the email, too, which is talk@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And let's take a few more phone calls. Lori in Hales Corners. Hi, Lori.
Hi, Kathleen. I love this show. And I wanted to mention that it brings up a very important point. Why did we have slavery? Cheap labor, right? And why sweatshops? We've got that today. Forced labor, cheap labor. And what can we do? I think we really need to be thinking about this. We need to care where our clothing comes from, sweatshops, our sugar, our tea, our coffee, our chocolate, and other things. And is the answer to buy American? Not really. We need to have it so that people who want to work in whatever country, any part of this globe, want to earn a living for themselves and their family and be treated decently doing it, we need to work on that.
Thank you, Lori, for your call. What modern-day lessons to be learned from Frederick Douglass? Russ?
You know, the caller is exactly right. And Douglass is, was centered in an economy in which cotton, right, and other products from the South were being shipped to the North. And so we can think about slavery solely as a Southern problem. That's incorrect, right? It was financed by Northern capital, financed by Northern interest. It facilitated Northern ways of life. And I think the caller, you know, is exactly right in encouraging us to think about contemporary echoes of this, which is why we should read Frederick Douglass, right? Because he impels us to make connections between types of slavery that existed in 1845 and types of economic servitude that exist today. Sometimes the similarities are more exact than others, but we need to understand, as Ivy said earlier, that this is a liberation text, and you know, we still have a lot of liberating to do.
Mm-hmm. Lori, thanks for the call. Tom in Prairie du Chien. Hi.
Hi. I'm curious if you could discuss his speeches. What sort of venues was he in? What was his audience made up of? And also, did his rhetoric in these speeches influence Martin Luther King by chance?
Mm, okay. Ivy?
Yeah, sure. This is...
I'm sorry, hello?
Did I... Yes.
Yeah. Douglass is by far in the 19th century... the so-called the leading race man before the emergence of Booker T. Washington. And as such, he was called upon His name was the first name that the people thought of when they wanted to invite a guest to speak about the ills of slavery or the plight of Black Americans in the 19th century. There's a very large archive of his speeches collected by historians. His audiences varied, but two key constituents were white liberal women and free Blacks who lived in the North. And he's circulating as an orator in these systems, which were much more pronounced in the 19th century. That is, there's a so-called lecture circuit that included preachers, intellectuals, and other kinds of advocates. And Douglas was one of the preeminent speakers on these networks.
In this particular book, Russ, who was his audience? Who did he hope would read this book? And was he surprised that people read this book in huge numbers?
I don't think he's surprised at all. I think the audience is as Ivy is describing it. And we have to, there's one important footnote to add to that. Douglas, after he escapes, he's worried about his ability to maintain his freedom in the North. So he expands his lecture circuit and goes to the British Isles and Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where he gets a very sizable audience, especially in Ireland, because there were these connections that were being made, even by Douglas in the narrative, between Irish emancipation and slave emancipation in the South. And Douglas gets a huge transatlantic following, and it's in some ways his reputation in Britain that enables his fame when he returns to the United States. So we need to think about him as not just a lecturer going to small towns in the Midwest, but really someone who had an international reputation.
Yeah. And let's just spend, if we could, 1 minute, because it's an important subject, on the economic system that was in slavery. How important it was to the South, to the North, the economic networks of slavery. Can you do that huge question in about a minute, Ivy?
I don't know if I can do it justice, but I mean, if the question is about the national system of slavery, I would reiterate Russ's really fine point that Northern capital is financing plantations in the South,
mm-hmm.
Either directly or indirectly. But I think the key issue here is that, you know, chattel slavery in the U.S. is not simply a national phenomenon. That is, it's an international one. It's a so-called world system, and all of these things are dovetail and are integrated with other kinds of economies, other kinds of politics, other forms of governance throughout the world. And so one way to think about Douglass's narrative, to me, is not simply about Black civil rights per se or dismantling the institution of slavery, but as Russ pointed out, there's a reason why the Irish in particular were attracted to Douglass. That is, they could see in Douglass's play as a slave analogies to their own condition living underneath kind of the proto-colonial
mm-hmm.
relationship with England, which in a broader sense then, if we abstract rather than particularize the struggles that Douglass is fighting, the struggles that Douglass are fighting against. This text is really a human rights
yes.
book. I think this is the key
yes.
thing. It's not simply about African-American civil rights or dismantling the institution, the peculiar institution of slavery, or even about a national cause, but this is really a human rights book.
Yeah, and thank you both so much. I'm so glad we did this particular selection. It's been my favorite so far. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you, Kathleen. It's always a pleasure.
Thanks. Ivy Wilson, Associate Professor of English, Director of American Studies at Northwestern University. Russ Castronovo, Professor of English and American Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Next month, Russ will be back to talk about civil disobedience, the classic essay by Henry David Thoreau, and we'll also have a second guest. So read Civil Disobedience, and we'll talk about it at 10 o'clock on Wednesday, December 19. Thanks to Brett Jaspers and Rhonda Fanning, who produced this program. The book again, Narrative of the Life of Frederick Douglass, in case you didn't read it and want to do so now. Everybody know.